Arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I've been teaching Dhamma. One of the things obviously a teacher thinks about is words and the value of words and the downfall of words. When the Buddha had his enlightenment, he was very reluctant to teach, apparently. And the tradition has it that it would be too difficult to understand. But then another voice arose in him and he decided to teach for those who have but little dust in their eyes. And so the teaching comes down to us in all manner of ways. And through the history of Buddhism, you see kind of many traps arising in Buddhist cultures and in Buddhist societies. And you say, like, Buddha images didn't really come on the scene for, what is it, 250 years or something like that? Long, long time. It was 500 years, I can't remember. But there was a reluctance to even anthropomorphize the Buddha, because once you get a statue, it's very easy to lose the idea of symbology, and the statue becomes something one reveres as an external thing, and you get idolatry. So there was a huge reluctance to actually do that. So if you go to the British Museum in England, in London, and you go to the Amaravati exhibit, and Amaravati was a huge cultural, a Buddhist center in south central India. And not the Amaravati in England. This is the original Amaravati. And there, it's very interesting, you'll find the British took some of the rock carvings for the museums. And you'll see a rock carving on one side. The Buddha is not depicted. So you'll see the oldest symbology of Buddhism. You'll see a Dharma chair, an empty chair, a teaching chair, a teaching platform, say, a Bodhi tree, but no one under the Bodhi tree, footprints, kind of stylized footprints. So there were different ways they represented the Buddha's presence, but they didn't create a human image. And then on some of these stones, interestingly enough, on the back of the stone, there are Buddha images. So a more classical kind of iconography arises, or a more humanized iconography, and you see images of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, images of a human being, say, sitting in a Dharma chair, images of a human being teaching other people. And that's the same stone. So what happened was that they, as the art forms changed, and iconography changed from those simple representations to more human representations, they took some of the rocks out, switched them around, and recarved them and put them back in again. And it's, I think, a kind of similar situation we have in the West sometimes is intellectualism, where we can have very erudite ideas about Buddhism and very clever descriptions of Buddhist ideas and remain at a kind of intellectual level and think that we know it. And I think that's a kind of idolatry as well, It's the idolizing of thought, the idolizing of intellect. But intellect itself, and it's important to kind of think of what is the importance, like what is right thought or right view? How does that work? Where does intellect fit into the spiritual life? And for me, it would be that intellect is not an end in itself, that it's a means. So we have images like the Zen master is pointing to the moon and the disciple is looking at the finger and not seeing the moon. You have those kind of images. So if one has a kind of very, very intellectual bent, then it's very tempting to just leave, continually seek more information, seek more ideas. But that doesn't really liberate the heart, because it's still information. Another trap is the emotional realms, where sometimes we think that compassion, and compassion is very, very important, but we think maybe that compassion is the goal. So on one hand, you might have thought being the goal, intellectual structures, which I think Western philosophy had a lot, these built-up Western structures of thought. Emotional, so sometimes people think it's the goal is to have some kind of emotional realization or some kind of emotional constancy. So something like compassion, you might think, well, compassion is the goal of Buddhism. But compassion itself is still a kind of constructed energy, mood, mindset. And so we'd say, as intellect is a part of the tool and is a method, so also compassion. Compassion is not the goal, it's the method. You have other things like ritualism and fundamentalism and dogmatism and so on and so forth. And you can see the traps that human beings get into in finding some kind of object, be it thought, be it emotional, be it a strong opinion, being a set of values like fundamentalism that they hold on to and think that those references are what where freedom lies and where what the Buddha was teaching. But they're always subject to change. So one sees people who are very much attached to intellect, say, intellectualism. The kind of traps of that can be vanity, arrogance, conceit, a kind of denigration of someone who might not be so clever. Or the other is where sometimes intellectualism can then fall into deep doubt. Someone can feel terribly confident, they've read something, and they've worked it out with their head, a kind of really difficult problem, and then they figured it out, and there's a kind of sense of intellectual confidence. But then something else comes along, and their mind brings up the feelings of doubt, intellectual doubt, and then they feel like they've lost it. Huh? Same with the, that's one extreme. The other, like, emotionally, one might think that, you know, one has a certain emotional construct like compassion and joy and so on, and thinks, now I've got it. You know, this is what I've really been working for. And then when it crumbles down and falls away and there's something more ordinary or bizarre or frightening, whatever, then we think, I've lost it. You know, I haven't got it anymore. So it's going back to thought, let's say during this sitting, I was feeling hot. I think it was a kind of probably common experience except for you. He's got a different thermostat than us. But anyway, so, like the feeling of being hot, if I just describe and I say it's hot, yeah. But it's not the same as actually the experience of heat in the body, is it? To actually experience the feeling of heat in the body, you have to stop thinking. to let go of thought and open the mind to the very feeling of heat. And then that's not an intellectual description, it's not a judgment, it's not an evaluation, it's just the way it really is. It's just, and even heat is an extra word. So if I drop all the language and I just stop and feel, then two things happen. First of all, I think first is that to actually do that, I have to actually stop. I have to come into the present moment. If I'm caught up in thinking, you know, it's hot. God, it's really hot. It's so hot. Why is it so hot? So the mind is just kind of playing around with ideas. But it's never actually stopping into the present moment and being with the feeling of heat. So to actually experience something non-intellectually, you can use thought to help you in that. I can say, well, what does heat really feel like? And not go into analysis, well, heat feels hot. But rather just to stop, and heat feels this way. So now I'm not using intellect as a kind of position, heat is good or bad. I'm not practicing intellectualism. I'm just using intellect or thought to come back to the present moment. So then intellect is a means rather than end in itself. It's not the final point. That's a very trivial example. It becomes more complex when life is more complex, when our emotional state or our bodily state or whatever becomes more complex. But the use of thought skillfully to do what? Why do we use thought? Why do we use these analyses that we have? Well, to me, it seems that the Dhamma is something here and now. It's not a matter of time. It's not something to be acquired later on. The Dhamma is not an idea. So that we could say the Dharma of heat is, we say, suchness or presence to that feeling. And this is the Dharma of heat. So that's one thing that this might do, using thought to bring you to the present moment. And what is important about that present moment is not the heat, but it's the knowing of the heat. And the object of my knowing now is bodily temperature, in this case, hot bodily temperature. But when there's a sort of presence of mind and the willingness to be aware of heat, the mind stops, and what begins to be noticed is the knowing itself, the presence to heat. And that is that's the sort of most important part of this bit, that within the feeling of heat, which is something that's changing and might be defined as comfortable or uncomfortable, but behind that or within that is the sense of knowing. And the knowing is not hot or cold. It's not big or small. It's something that is the gateway to peace. Now that's not something that's an idea. It's not something that's even an emotion. It's something even beyond that. It's a possibility that doesn't get noticed if, first of all, we are so abstract that we're thinking all the time. And secondly, it doesn't get noticed if we are just obsessed with the objective world. And we don't notice that all objects point to one subject. All objects point to one knowing. And it's in that knowing that I think Buddhism is pointing to the peace of the heart, peace of the mind. You can do that with any of the senses. So you could say, that's a beautiful shrine. Isn't that a lovely shrine? I don't know, those gladiolas look a bit done. I'll have to change the flowers tomorrow. Oh, but maybe I'll bring some flowers and water. So that's thinking about the shrine, which is good thinking, you know. It's nothing wrong with it. But actually to just know the shrine as it is, to look at the shrine, you have to stop thinking. And you can use thought to help you with that. You can say, what does the shrine really look like? to really notice what the shrine looks like, you have to stop, and you have to kind of let the shrine come to you. Right? And just let it come to you. And then you notice. And it's not an aesthetic appreciation. It's not saying the rupa is beautiful or not. Or you can notice, oh, that's a beautiful rupa, that's not a beautiful rupa. Or you can notice how it affects you. But just the fact of focusing on looking and just allowing the looking to bring the object to you, as it were, rather than going out and trying to do something and organize it, requires what? Requires us to stop and stay present for a while. So thought, what does the shrine look like, is a means to an end, and that end is being present. And then, what does the object, the visual object, point to? It points to seeing. And seeing, what does seeing point to? It's awareness. And it's the same awareness that we have with the heat of the body. Right? And that's the factor of where peace lies. The visual image changes, and it's sometimes nice, sometimes not nice. We go blind, lights go out. The temperature changes, put on a sweater, take off a sweater. Put on the fan, take off the fan, changes, heat. But the knowing, the awareness, that's a constant. And because of our, because we're distracted by pain and pleasure, we tend not to notice that knowing. We tend to be very much taken up with objects. Visual objects, emotional objects, inner objects, outer objects, thoughts, ideas, anticipation, evaluation, judgment, memory, regret, remorse, and so on. These are all objects of mind-body experience. You can do a sound, can't you? Right? You can, like the fan. You say, oh, that is a loud fan. Maybe you're sitting there and poor old Jill was getting it right in the face, number 3 speed, right? So she probably thought, woo, I'm going to muss my hair up here. Or whatever. But that would be, you know, it's quite a strong sense, impression. Strong wind and strong sound. So the mind would say, number 2 would be nicer. Or this is, oh gosh, it's windy here. Maybe I should go to the other side of the room. That's thought, which is a valid way of thinking. It can move and you can change the speed and so on. But also you could say, I wonder what this really sounds like. What is third speed sound like? So that is using intellect to do what? To come back to the present moment, but then to notice what the sound of the fan is actually like, would I have to stop? Well, I have to actually listen, not think about it. If I think about it, it's too strong, that's not the feeling, that's a judgment of it. Not that the judgment is wrong, I'm not saying it's wrong, but to actually feel something, or listen, in this case sound, listen, feel, you have to stop. And in the stopping of the mind, not only do you begin to recognize this sound, but you notice, that the sound is pointing to the listening. The sound is pointing to the listening. So whether it's the listening, whether it's the seeing, it's all awareness, really, the knowing. And the mistake that people make then is that they always... In spiritual life, quite often the mistake they make is, of course, they go out into the object. So intellectualism or emotionalism, I don't even know if there is such a word, or dogmatism, or and so on and so forth, the mind is always very much caught up with views and opinions, with emotional evaluation. This is a good emotion, it's a bad emotion. And at some level, that's true. You know, like to be frightened all the time is not a very nice emotion. But even a negative emotion, if there's awareness, can be known, and even a negative emotion points to the knowing. So you have sound, you have sight, you have bodily feeling, you have mental impressions, smells, odors, right? So you have like mental impressions, they're a bit more complex. So maybe some kind of a emotional trigger is touched, and I feel terribly inadequate, say. So terribly inadequate. Yeah. So then the inadequacy runs my thinking. gosh, I'm just not getting anywhere in this, or I should have done this better, and some form of self-disparagement, inadequacy begins to generate thinking. And the thinking might be that, oh, if I didn't have this inadequacy, then I could be, you know, I'd be a really together person. So maybe I start to think ways of not to be inadequate if I do this and I do that and da 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 da. And the mind becomes engaged with thinking, which is also very much emotionally triggered and pushed. But if I use intellect, and that would be where I really trust the intellect a lot, and I think all of us have seen where when my intellect is driven by negative emotion, it can really go off. I can just go off into a tangent of self-hatred or hatred of others or worry, and it just takes me, because it's an intellect, when it's driven by wrong factors, when it's not seen and understood, it's driven by ego and self-view and all kinds of things which cause me and others a lot of suffering. And that would be the inability to know thought as thought. But if I have a capacity then to feel emotion and know thought as an object, which is quite a big step for humanity, rather than just be the subject of all my thinking all the time, I know thought as an object, there's a chance to like really listen to thinking and see that in that listening, whatever the thought is, in that knowing of thought, there's something very peaceful. So maybe that like the thoughts are very self-disparaging very like a lot of self-doubt or something like that. And then they're kind of, what is this thinking saying? What's the emotion behind the thinking? What are that? That's using thought, right? But not as a final belief, but actually as an access, as a way of accessing what's going on. There is this thinking process linked to an emotion. And then in that listening and knowing, the emotion itself is known, and you see that that also points to clarity, presence, awareness. And it's also peaceful. So, the objective world has its place, and we need to organize the objective world, and we need to cook meals and put gas in the car and make sure the taxes are paid and all these ordinary things, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's the only thing we have, if we only have the objective world of the things we're engaged in, then it's always a very externalized life, and we get some happiness, certainly, you know. And so when we live a moral life, when we live a good life, when we live a life of responsibility, social responsibility, and when we live a life which is in imbued with good communication and so on, we get benefit. We get beautiful benefit. We tend to have more friendships. We tend to just have less remorse. And so life has a kind of stability and a kind of happiness. And the Buddha certainly recommended that to live the good life. To live the good life means to do good things, to do good deeds, to do good actions, to speak in ways which are skillful. But that itself is not the end. That's not the end, that's the means for the Buddha's deeper realization. Because if that was the end in itself, then just living a kind of moral life would be sufficient. But the Buddha was offering something which is actually deeper than just a say, kind of social convention. It's good, it's necessary, in fact. It's necessary to live a moral life. You can't do this work if you don't. And it's very important to be generous and responsible. But that, not as an end in itself, but as a kind of foundation or a platform for what? Some kind of stability of consciousness. A life, a social life which is lived in a totally chaotic way just has a chaotic result in the mind. Learning how to then stay attentive in the present moment, the practices of meditation also are beneficial, but not as an end in itself. So just learning to stay with the breath, say, or the sound of silence or whatever, what does that do? It holds attention into the present moment by choosing an object. So you can choose an object. You can choose an object, the breath, the mantra, visualization, heart practice, various ways to do it. And by choosing the object and choosing to be in the moment, just even not choosing an object, choosing to be in the moment, is a training of mind, but not an end in itself. Because if my whole practice is still dependent on holding on to an object, when that object falls away, when I get sick, like if I'm doing breath meditation, I get asthma. I know I've never had asthma, but you know, I get asthma. Anapanasati is going to be very difficult. I might panic. But if I use mindfulness of breathing or other practices to begin to just be more aware of this presence, that the breath points to this presence, and if I got asthma, I could still be with the presence. I could still be with mindfulness because I wasn't dependent on the object. So people who meditate and become very dependent on the object for tranquility quite often find that the transition to something more complex or difficult, because they get attached to tranquility. Tranquility is good, you know, it's really, really energizing and gives you lots of energy, but not as an end in itself, because tranquility is still dependent on conditions. And so meditation has a place, but if meditation is a kind of quietism, where I'm always just trying to organize my life and my mind and control it, so it's always very, very quiet, I don't have to do anything and so on, then oftentimes that attachment leads to a feeling of being threatened by other things, an aversion to complexity, an aversion to people who come into my space, or fear of bodily pain or whatever. Whereas meditation, which is just helping us ground in awareness in a constant way, in a continuing way, has a whole different tenor about it. It's not about holding on to something, it's about strengthening something which you know, so that when the environment, the meditation environment, all of a sudden changes to like going into London or whatever, then it's okay. So I'd say I taught a 9-day retreat at Amaravati, and then I had to go in town the next day to go to visit a friend who's very sick, and on the tube, lots of people, and we got lost, and missed the tube by 2 minutes. It took another hour to get the tube, and all kinds of interesting things like that. Lots of people, and if I was dependent on tranquility of a monastery and a meditation technique and so on, then of course the complexity can be very negative. But if the refuge is in awareness, and that's strengthened through tranquility practices, then when chaos comes and mistrains and all of that, and so this is what it feels like to be annoyed. We missed the train. Right? And it, certainly I felt annoyed. Annoyance feels this way, and then it goes. I wanted the train, didn't get it, didn't get what I wanted. So the reference of awareness is always, even annoyance, in this case, is pointing back to awareness. Success, failure point back to awareness. The good, bad point back to awareness. And that's really it's a very elegant practice if you think about it. It's not very complex. But it's terribly difficult to do, it seems. Because our attention is always grabbed by objects, usually thought. And our minds become very easily preoccupied with all kinds of ruminations and histories, and our minds usually have a lot of anticipation in them. If you look at that, if you just begin to use something like anticipation as an object of awareness, whatever one is anticipating, just that, just the whole sense of anticipating the next experience, the next piece of responsibility, whatever, you see, whoa, that's really strong. Anticipation feels this way, but it's still pointing to awareness. Whereas if I believe in the anticipation, then I become the anticipator, as it were. And I think that by solving the problems of anticipation somehow I'm going to be free. That's a kind of idolatry. That's like idolizing anticipation, believing in anticipation, thinking that that's the real truth. Functional planning is fine, isn't it? But just the mind-driven evaluation, where the mind can be constantly evaluating your performance, like every meditation, oh, that was a good meditation, that was a bad meditation, I'm doing well, I'm not doing well, she's not very good, he's all right, she's not good, she's good, da-da-da-da-da-da. That's a kind of mindset. And when the mindset is like totally believed in, there's no there's no real sense of knowing. But if there's enough mindfulness, say, oh, evaluation feels this way. What do you have to do? To do that, you have to stop and listen to thought. Feel the body. Feel the body. What's the tension being created in the body? And in that stopping, both two things happen. You tend not to proliferate in those ways. The energy of those things has a chance to die away. But more importantly, it's always pointing to your real home. You're coming home. Coming home to know, oh, anticipation feels this way. Always coming home, coming home. Whereas thinking that, not even noticing it, most people don't even think, notice it. There's minds, you're always running to the future, running to the future, just kind of running. And that lack of noticing, that lack of awakeness, that lack of listening in this open-hearted, receptive way, means that we're not available. We're not available for peace. We're not available for insight, because our minds are taken up with the old, taken up with the habits of the old, the kind of constructs that we always get caught up into, the habitual sense of self and other that we get caught up into. And if that's where our attention is located, then how can we experience peace? How can we experience that fresh insight? There's no way, because the mind has no space. It's not available. That's an interesting word. I was using that a lot on the retreat, just be available. It's a kind of weird word, but you think about it, to be available to this moment, what do you have to do? To stop, listen, know, and then you are availability itself. It's a funny way of talking, but I mean, it's the way you can use words to kind of play around, but be availability, and I'm not going to write a book about it. But you see what I mean? Be that. And then there's no anticipation in that. If I think, what's he talking about? I'm going to get something out of this, so I'm going to try to be available. There's a whole sense of me trying to get something to do something. But the practices of awakening, the practices of coming home, are always like the suchness of this moment. It feels this way now. And then the thinking mind, and the planning mind, and the organizing mind. So how can we do that? How can we live in the world and do our planning? You know, and actually be responsible and pay for the mortgage. And yet, also find this very peaceful place in our hearts. And both are possible. Both are necessary. You know, both are necessary, I think. Because in the peace of knowing this objective world, coming and going, we find a kind of resolution where the objective world no longer is so compelling and important, because we found something in our hearts which is very fulfilling. And then the objective world is as it is. It can be beautiful, it could not be beautiful, but it's no longer so fraught with our needs, because our needs are fulfilled through coming home. If our needs are always externalized, then we'll never be fulfilled. Because each time we get something, it fades and we want something else. And what we do is we perpetuate this kind of need for objects, need for externalities. Well, here we're coming home. Now, as I was saying to someone this morning, in the morning meditation, they were kind of fidgeting a lot. And I said to the person, you know, one of the things we train in, we train in being aware of discomfort. We call it training in dukkha vedana. Now, it's kind of interesting, because usually anything discomfort, we see comfort. But if you know, like in sitting practice, what are you doing? You sit down, you choose a posture, you set your posture up, and then you try not to fidget, right? You try not to fidget. And what you do is you use like the feelings of discomfort. So then, you know, you feel some slight pain, not much, just a bit. But rather than shifting all the time and trying to find the comfortable posture, you begin to know the very feeling of discomfort. And that knowing of the feeling of discomfort is the center. You're coming home. Whereas believing in discomfort and moving on to comfort all the time, you know, I think all of us who have learned how to meditate, you know, don't buy into that. You'll just be shifting every 5 seconds. So by being aware of discomfort, the discomfort brings you back to awareness. By being caught up with the discomfort, you seek another object, and the other object is comfort. Right? So I think, well, comfort, that's what I want. I want comfort. That'll do. Right? And certainly at some point, yeah, I want comfort. I'm getting out of this posture because it hurts too much. But there is something before that extreme sense of discomfort, there is something about us which knows that just shifting all the time isn't going to really work. So why do we, you know, as meditators, why do we? We notice discomfort, it's uncomfortable, and you'd like the other, but you bear with it in a kind way, you know, not in a kind of hurtful way. You bear with it, and the mind becomes peaceful, doesn't it? Becomes peaceful. Why is that? Because the mind is now chosen not to pursue objects, but be the knowing of the objective experience of discomfort. So the mind's no longer going out all the time to seek one or the other, get rid of the discomfort, seek the comfort. You've chosen, I'll stay home now, thank you. And discomfort feels this way. That's different than the worldly ways of always trying to get pleasure and get rid of displeasure. This isn't self-mortification, it's just understanding how the mind works. So training in discomfort, I mean, I don't think that's going to sell in the world. Right, I don't think Nike would take that as a kind of advert. So there's a kind of wisdom that the Buddha suggested to forego immediate pleasure for long-term peace, to forego the immediate comfort of something for long-term peace. Now that if you apply that to your body, you learn a simple lesson with your body. Then you take something more extreme, like a really difficult relationship situation or emotional situation where you forego the pleasure of running away from something difficult from your own heart. You forego that comfort for the long-term liberation from the need to do something and run away from that. And that's more difficult. That's more difficult. But it's the same principle. So if you learn these principles, like the way I like to kind of think about it, we begin with something very neutral, right? Begin with the sound of the fan. And to come to listening, receptive. Get a sense of centeredness there. All right? That's the lesson. Receptive, still, neutral. Then have enough intention then to apply that to the first discomfort you feel in the body when you're sitting. And that's not saying you must sit and not move. That's not it. The first discomfort you feel, it's the same principle. Just listen to the discomfort. And then apply it to more and more difficult and complex situations. Same principle. So all things point back to this knowing, this awareness, the peace of the mind. All right? I'll leave that for your reflection.
Oh.